Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Jody Kretzman, who will be speaking on rebuilding our cities. So let's listen in on Jody Kretzman.
My name is Jody Kretzman, and this is a session called Rebuilding Our Cities, with a question after it, an impossible dream. I want to answer the question right away. No, it's not an impossible dream. So we can end now. So the rest of our session is figuring out why I said that and why people who work in cities are thinking about that that these days. This is a this is the one session that I'm going to do on that this week, but I'd like to pack a lot into it. But I'd also like to just get a sense of both who you are and whether you've lived in a city recently, and if so, which one, and just a word or two about your impressions of how it's doing. what you think the sort of state of your city is. And if you haven't lived anywhere near one, that's fine too. We can go with vicarious experience.
We've got a definition on size as to what a city is?
Oh, let's say anything 50,000 and over. At this point, I spend my own time in bigger cities, but 50,000 and over is. Let's do a quick round here. Hi.
Hi, I'm Judy Finn.
Hi, Judy.
And I'm a lawyer and an urban studies person.
Really? Where?
In Tulsa.
Huh.
I've been involved in rebuilding the floodplains of Tulsa.
Huh.
We started out being worst in the country, and now we're number one in the country in terms of floodplain management. So we have tackled one small, relatively small, but for us was a bigger problem.
Yeah.
That solved it. We have all the other urban problems that everybody else has. And I think it's just a matter of deciding that we want to solve it.
Sure.
And it doesn't take very many people, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Okay, one optimistic report from Tulsa.
My name is Gail, and my husband and I live in Bangkok. I don't know whether I'd be terribly optimistic or not. We have a lot of work cut out for us, all of us who are living there and trying to help Bangkok with its urban problem.
That would be fun to do some comparison and contrast. We'll be talking mostly about North American cities here in the U.S. and Canada, but yeah, interesting.
I'm Tom Allen. I come from Salem, Oregon, the capital city.
Uh-huh.
The problem I think that Oregon is having is rebuilding the city is one thing, but paying for it is another.
Yes, okay. They do go together.
So, so it's trying to focus your efforts in one place.
Yeah.
You come from Salem. My sister's from there, too. Are you worried at all about the build-up of penal institutions around that time? Mm-hmm.
We are supposedly the 13th safest city in the Northwest. So. I don't think the buildup really. There's enough younger people coming in that I don't think the buildup of penal institutions is going to make a change.
A lot of people in cities that are desperate economically see that as the last straw in terms of economic development. It's build more prisons, at least it's jobs. It's a sort of one sign of our desperation, I think. We're doing a quick round of introductions in cities we know and love, or don't.
I'm Dean Dickinson, raised in Chicago.
Really?
But for the past 35 years, I've been living in Richland, Washington, which is a little bit too small to meet your criteria.
Okay. Hey, Chris.
Chris Widener from Reading, Pennsylvania, about 75,000. A lot of parts of living in our city is great. We're going through a lot of change with influx of Hispanic Latino folks. That's pretty rapid, scares a lot of people. A lot of neat cultural gifts with that, too. The city these days is putting a lot of stock and hoping to be designated an enterprise zone or the majority of the city by the federal government. I'm not sure if that's, you know, if we should put all our eggs in that basket, but that's what some are hoping for.
All right. If somebody would help write that legislation, I wouldn't put a whole lot of eggs in that basket. Talk about that. Yeah.
I'm Mert Warnaking, and I have lived in Portland, but right now I live in the urban area of Washington County, which is just to the west of Portland. And I've been involved, quite involved, with land use planning through the citizen participation organizations and the CCI.
Great.
And Portland right now is trying to swallow the eastern part of Washington County. It's an area of about 40,000 people. And both Beaverton and Portland want the area.
Mm-hmm.
And in Portland, we'd be nothing. They just want our money. In Beaverton, we would be half the population. So.
It's a good choice there, yes.
But Portland,
with power.
Yeah, Portland has... It's gone to the, started through the court system, and it's back at Metro right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Portland's a very interesting city in lots of ways. A little bit.
Well, there's a lot going on. Yeah. We have light rail going in. Yeah. They're doing a 2040 plan.
Yeah. Good. Joanne.
I'm Joanne.
San Francisco,
Chadwick.
In Detroit.
I returned to Chicago after 25 years. I'm much more optimistic about the Chicago today than I was the Chicago 25 years ago. I left the city of Detroit where I was, would not have the optimism that I have about Chicago. So we can talk to you about that.
I'm Sharon Barnes from Austin, Minnesota, a community of about 23,000. And I travel frequently to Rochester, Minnesota. Rated by Money Magazine as the number one city to live in last year, and I'm always glad to come back to our, to also travel frequently to Minneapolis, St. Paul. I'm always happy to come back to my little community.
Sure. Things are a little bit more manageable. Mm-hmm. Skills,
yeah,
yes.
Don't have the traffic.
Absolutely.
Can't work in 10 minutes.
So. Right. So from manageable to unmanageable.
I think I know. I'm Carol Martin, and I'm from Los Angeles, and we're really interested in rebuilding because our city is in the street now with all the bricks and stuff just still laid out on the streets.
Yeah.
The earthquake.
Yeah, absolutely. Doing a quick round of introductions in cities you are close to or not.
My name is Ashley. I'm Bill Jekyll. I can speak English.
Okay. Do you spend time in Tokyo or Osaka or?
Osaka.
Osaka. Great. It's a wonderful city. Interesting city.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm Laurel Robinette, and since my 8-year-old son Cecil was an infant, we've been living in a small town in eastern Washington. But 10 years prior to that, I lived in Seattle for 10 years. And I guess I'm curious about it, not only because I've known a lot of architects that were real visionaries about how cities should be planned, but also because I found city life in Seattle, which is not a monstrous city by any means, an affliction. I rode mass transit every day to my job, and I found it difficult. I found it difficult to deal with the enormous variety of people.
Yeah. There are clearly downsides, or at least trade-offs. City living, absolutely.
Hey. I'm Tom Harold. I live in Longview, Washington, and Southwest Washington. And it's a the county, it's Collins County, population is 85,000. The reason why I came to your session was I'm concerned because 10% of all counties in the nation with population of 100,000 or more have financial problems.
Yes.
And that's why I'm here. It's not only the cities, it's the counties. It's the way it's the way it's being run.
Yes.
What they're doing with their money.
I'm Sven Westlund. I have lived in Incorporated City since I was married. I live in Holden.
Yes.
The only place that I know where the stop sign stops the main road traffic by the side road.
Yeah. That's a good way to say it.
Yeah.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello. I'm Elizabeth Westlund, and I'm Sven Adopter.
I'm Rick Dunning. I commute on a daily basis to Minneapolis, so I have that perspective from that city. It seems, by most reports, to be a healthy one, though they keep losing all their professional sports teams. I don't know.
Yeah, but they didn't let the Timberwolves move.
Gary Sonnen, and I'm from Salt Lake City, and I've been there a good part of my life, and recently it's really growing fast. I think it has one of the better economies, but there's a lot of problems. It's getting crowded, and I think it's growing too fast as far as I'm concerned.
It is booming.
Yeah.
I'm Hal Hassett of Portland, Oregon. And I'm the total American. You know, over the last 15 years, Portland is really growing, the traffic's been a problem. So, all of California has been there, so 15 years from now, it's going to be a really hassle place, I think.
And there's some fear about that at this point.
Pat, Cal Phillips, I live in Portland, Oregon, grew up in upstate New York. Share the same views about Portland as we just mentioned.
Well, it's a nice range of cities, but they are sort of northern tier and western, northwest, west coast cities, with the exception of Detroit and Chicago, Joanne, and Reading, Chris. Yes. I think, let me just say a few things, and then let's see if we can, I hope we're going to have some time during the rest of the week for discussion. I want to lay the table today for some discussion that might happen for the rest of the week on an informal kind of basis. I think Holden is a wonderful place to think about cities. Yeah. Partly because it is urban, despite the fact that the stop signs stop the traffic on Main Street. It is also a place that is clearly a port of entry. Immigration happens every day here, right? And there's high mobility. People are constantly moving in and out. And there's probably always more choices than people can make. And those are three major characteristics of cities. Immigration, high mobility, and lots of choices. And Holden has all of that. And besides that, what is fun for me as somebody who works in cities is the fact that at Holden, all of its skeleton is visible. You can see where the stuff comes in, whether it's water off the mountain or stuff up the barge and up the lake, and you can see where it goes out. And sometimes you have to work hard to uncover that in cities, and we have it buried both physically and in layers of bureaucracy in ways that we don't have at Holden. So it's a wonderful place to think about what the possibilities are for community here. And I think the other thing that's been interesting for us about Holden for the last 15 or 20 years that we've been coming here from Chicago, which is my base, is that Holden is a place that has discovered from its beginning as a retreat center in 1960 what it is to build community based on the gifts and talents and resources of the people who come here, right? I want to tell you just a quick story about a little odyssey that I've been on for the last few years and how it comes around full circle for me to the lessons that I've learned at Holden. I was born in Chicago and went away for a while, did school in the East, and came back in 1967 and was a community organizer on the west side of Chicago, which is the poorest community in Chicago. Was turning African American then, is now totally a black community. And my major emotional investment has always been in the church basements and on the street corners and occasionally in the taverns of the west side of Chicago. And the view from what it looks like in those communities has been the view that has most sort of influenced what I think about when I'm thinking about cities. And so over the past 25 or 30 years, some of my time has been spent at Northwestern University at a research center there called the Center for Urban Affairs and Policy Research, where we've had a little corner of the university which is devoted more fully than any place else I know in the country to asking a question that people interested in cities don't often ask, which is not about finance and not about planning, but it's about how communities in cities solve problems. How do local communities in cities solve problems has been our sort of focus in the way we've sort of thought about things. The last 5 years of that work has been incredibly exciting because we got a little money. A colleague of mine in Afro-American Studies named Charles Payne and a colleague in something called Communication Studies named John McKnight. And I got some money to travel around the United States to the 25 largest cities, including a little time in Portland and Seattle, certainly a lot of time in Detroit, Philadelphia, and to do something that university folk don't usually do. Our task was to go to the most distressed communities in those cities and to spend time with people in the most distressed communities in those cities, but not talking with them about what went wrong, about the incredible devastation that makes up the west side of Chicago or public housing in Washington, D.C., or just the acre upon acre of bombed out and burned out urban landscape that is the South Bronx, or now South Central Los Angeles. Right? Instead, what we were after was success stories. What in the most unlikely places, in absolutely devastated, hopeless urban America, what worked? What was it that people were doing in the midst of all of that, right? That somehow energized folks, and we were very, very unacademic and loose about our definition of worked, of success. What we wanted was stories that were about the imparting of hope. What was it that was going on in South Central Los Angeles, or the South Bronx, or public housing all over the United States that somehow energized people and got them to buy into the possibility that this community and their family and their future could somehow be hopeful, right? So that was our sort of task. So what I want to say is a few of the lessons from that odyssey. And I think the top one is that you can't imagine how much hopeful stuff is going on in the midst of the rubble. It is just incredible. One of the things that it seems to me what we have here is a set of building blocks that are more or less, from the point of view of most of us who get our news about cities from mass media, more or less under our radar, if you will, more or less invisible. But they are seeds, the mustard seed reading of the gospel of this week. They are seeds of a different way of thinking about cities, and they are seeds, it seems to me, that may in fact hold a key to rethinking the polity and eventually economy of urban America, which means rethinking the polity and economy of the country, I think, since I am one who is convinced that as urban America goes, so goes our country. Most of you probably know, who are interested in cities, that the federal government withdrew about, name your date, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, certainly 13 years ago, withdrew its interest, withdrew any sort of creative interest in rebuilding cities. So that while some of the old money kept dribbling into cities, it too began dwindling, and certainly no new ideas were seeded in City. What did that do? One of the things it did was to make people fall on all kinds of incredibly hard times. And this has been a tough decade and a half in urban America, there's no doubt about it. But the other thing that it did, and we've got to recognize it if we're going to move forward from this place, is that it let loose an incredible amount of creativity. So that there are now inventions, social, political, and economic inventions in neighborhoods across the United States which weren't there 15 or 20 years ago, and which have the possibility of remaking cities. So, for example, nobody's been building low-income housing in the United States except community development corporations, which basically didn't exist 18 years ago. And community development corporations in the last 10 years have built 600,000 units of low-income housing. Little not-for-profit community development corporations, almost all in cities, building 100 here, 10 here, in a couple of places, a few thousand, right? And often, by the way, with churches at the center of their activity, right? I told a story the other day about one of my favorite places, Bethel, New Life on the west side of Chicago, a very poor African-American community where I first started community organizing. Little Lutheran church of 40 people 12 years ago, deciding whether to go or stay. And after much discussion, deciding to stay, but then wondering how to stay usefully in their community, looking around what needed to be done and what they had to do it with. All they had to do it with was a church building, which was in pretty good shape, Chris, you're right. And they mortgaged it. And with the mortgage money, they bought a dilapidated three flat down the block. And after church service, every Sunday morning for 6 months, everybody went down and put their hands to the hammers, and they redid that apartment building and rented it out. And then they bought another after 6 months, and they bought another. And it's 12 years later now, this little congregation of 40 people is now a community development corporation of $10 million a year that employs 650 people. The congregation is now about, what, 450, 500, Joe, something like that. Has about 20 businesses, 20 different kinds of businesses, manufacturing businesses, recycling businesses, a lot of construction businesses, home management businesses, a whole array of stuff going on in that neighborhood. It's the second biggest employer on the west side of Chicago. And it's clearly a force in rethinking what's going on not only in that neighborhood, but in the entire city of Chicago. Stories like that all over the place. Some of them $10 million stories, others of them $100 million stories. The story of Newark, New Jersey, right? The New Communities Corporation, which came out of a Catholic priest's meeting with his church council 15 years ago in his basement, is now a $100 million a year operation, running three different shopping centers, employing 1,500 people, having rehabbed about 3,000 units of housing. It's just an amazing story. So we were collecting those stories, but we were also collecting the smaller stories, the stories that really are under the radar, because those, for people who are interested in cities, you know about those stories. You know about the big $10 and $100 million stories, of which there are many. But the little stories about the women who decide that public housing, for example, can actually be a humane place, and a place that, if they were to manage it themselves, could in fact be a place to raise their families. So the resident management corporation movement within public housing as a way to reclaim, retake home, redefine home, has also taken off. And there are now dozens and dozens of resident management corporations around. You can increasingly now find public housing that actually works, where it's actually a pleasure to go in, where you know you're not going to get shot or stabbed or robbed, and where people have clearly sort of taken pride in where they are. Lots of churches that have decided that the epidemic of violence and drugs is a combination of an economic problem and a spiritual problem. And what's defined as a combination of economics and spirit have begun to find ways to reconnect to young people. This stuff is going on all over the place, friends, and it is going on mostly without coordination, without sort of an imprimatur from Washington, D.C., right? Nobody's sort of orchestrating this stuff. The church bodies sort of at most tolerate it, right, Joe? I mean, Chris, right? They don't, there's nothing in the national church bodies, Catholic or Protestant, or as far as I know, Jewish, that has anything sort of creative to seed out there, right? So it is a real, it seems to me, moment where the creative spirit is working in localities and sort of pushing itself up. What's going on here? Let me just suggest the major thing that's going on here. Now, after we've talked to these people, we've collected hundreds of stories. We've got a plug here. It's unfortunately, this book came out a couple months ago, and it's already sold out. It's first printing. There's a little book called Building Communities from the Inside Out that is about this process that I'm telling you about. The major lesson here, I think, that we've heard over and over and over again, is that people have said, poor people in devastated communities, they have said, finally, we understand what our prison is made up here in the South Bronx, or here in the west side of Chicago, or here in public housing. And we understand it's made partly of economics, and it's made partly of a kind of abandonment by mainstream institutions. And it's partly made about, it's made up of race. But over and over again, what we heard was that the prison people were beginning to break out of, as they were describing it to us, was made up of ideas about who they were, but about ideas that we all hold about who people in public housing are. We do a quick test here. Nobody here is from New York, so let's just see if this works outside of New York. If I say to you the words South Bronx, do you have images that pop into your head?
DK.
Soot.
Soot?
Empty buildings, tenements.
Empty buildings, tenements, abandoned buildings. What else?
Poverty.
Stripped cars, yes. Just like at Fields Point.
Killings,
violence.
Yes,
lots of violence. Gangs.
Homeless.
Yes.
Drugs.
Homelessness, drugs. Yes, we're there. Is it like this? If I could get this down in a way that makes sense.
Interesting.
Turn it over.
There we go.
Is it like a neighborhood needs map? This is a little playful. We're thinking about what is it that appears in people's heads when you say South Bronx or public housing, or sometimes when you say inner city at all. Something like this, I think, now appears in people's heads. This isn't meant to be spatially accurate or to have any kind of a mathematical relationship in terms of the space occupied. It's meant to be an image, a set of images about what we have in our heads. What we heard over and over from people in communities was, this is a map about them that they didn't make up, but which defines who they are. You see? What's wrong with this map? Let's just think about this for a second.
Nothing good.
Huh?
Nothing good.
There's nothing good. Absolutely. It is unremitting in its negativity. Right? It describes people and communities in ways we would never describe each other. And in ways that Holden folks particularly would never describe each other, right? We've been taught by folks in communities across the country that the problem with this map is not that it's not a true map. It is a true map. But the problem with this map is that it's not the whole truth. And it gets treated as if it's real simple-minded for a minute, Joe, and do what I did the other day. This is a glass that's half full, or almost. I didn't get this prop arranged ahead of time. But it's also half empty. And the simple-minded suggestion is, which has been pounded into our heads again and again over the last little while, is that this is a glass half full and half empty. It's like everybody in this room. Right? I mean, I know Gary and Joanne and Carol. You can't even know Elizabeth, Sven, Chris, Rick well enough to know that, like me, they are empty people. That they have their needs, their problems, their deficiencies, right? That there are maps like this, like I am. But I also know those folks, and I suspect the same thing is true of everybody else in this room, well enough to know that they are incredibly full people. They are gifted. They have capacities. They have resources. They are filled. We're all like that. Every working congregation, every working community, Holden, every working organization is always based on the gifts, capacities, resources of people who are also empty, deficient, needy, problematic. My colleagues at Northwestern, I sometimes talk about them. I think I did the other day. My professor friends at Northwestern are incredibly empty people. They're people who can't keep a family together. They're people whose kids don't speak to them. They're people who, some of them who drink too much, some of them who have taken drugs too much, some of them get depressed, some of them, they can keep an army of people whose job it is to fill them up, helpers, counselors, busy for years, my colleagues at Northwestern University, which is a pretty good university. And I know it's true of your colleagues at the ELCA headquarters, Joe. like Northwestern, if we ask people to come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning at the ELCA or at Northwestern and say, bring me your problems, your needs, your deficiencies.
They do bring them.
Yes, right. We could, if that's the way we organize our day, right, as you know, sometimes it actually happens, probably at your place, it doesn't happen that often at mine. We could have a day-long or week-long or month-long therapy session.
Yes.
And nobody would ever get anything done that had to do with building the organization, building the community. Again, the simple point is that no community has ever been built based on the emptiness and deficiency of people, on their neediness, on their, because empty and deficient and needy people always need to be filled up from the outside. They need help. This map is a map that is about emptiness. And this map has been our sole guide to policy in cities over the last 25 years. And because, out of the best of intentions, we have wanted to help, we have built up a series of structures and systems and institutions that are about filling up emptiness and not recognizing the fullness that is there. You see, people in the South Bronx and in public housing didn't draw this map about themselves. This map was drawn by universities, my own place. Social science is, when aimed at cities, the quantification of miseries. Churches respond to emptiness and needs. Foundations in the United Way ask for needs surveys. And a needs survey is an invitation for a local community to draw this map about itself. Tell us about your emptiness and we'll give you money. Right. Government Human Service bases billions and billions of dollars of money programs based on this map. They go in by categories. Right? Every phrase on this map, if you put it on the top of a funding application, you could get it funded. Because it's a way of saying, look how needy and empty we are. Fill us up. And the mass media have no idea that any other map to the South Bronx exists, or the public housing, or even these days, probably, the even inner city Seattle or Portland. Not sure about that. Maybe some other things that work here. In general, though, this map, when applied in terms of its emptiness to individuals, defines people as recipients or clients. Empty people are recipients or clients. Full people are something else. We used to call them citizens. And communities are always places, and cities, after all, go back to the root, are always places that get built by full people called citizens, not empty people called clients and recipients. So all we have found over and over and over again is that folks in local neighborhoods who have recognized the trap that this map represents, the fact that this is a map that's about ever-increasing dependency, the fact that this is a map basically that is about, at most, survival of individuals. And it's never a map about developing communities. You can't go by this map and think about building or developing communities. This is a map for the survival of individuals at best, which I have nothing against, but let's not fool ourselves as to what it's about. Have recognized also, finally, that this is a map that's about hopelessness. If I'm a kid on a street corner or if I'm in the White House, this is a map that leads me clearly to the rational conclusion that there is no hope. If this is what my community looks like, why should I invest, if I'm a kid on the corner, in myself, in education, in job training, in something that looks to the future, you see? Because there is no future. And if I'm Clinton, why should I back more money for cities when it just goes down a deep and ever-deepening hole? This is a map that says, if you want more money, tell us next year that your problem's even worse, despite your best efforts, and we'll come in and fund it again. That's what this map is about. But even if, so over and over and over again in these hundreds of stories, what we find is that people have said, we didn't draw this map about ourselves. It's truth, but it's not the whole truth. And if we're serious about rebuilding community, we need another kind of map. We need a map that begins to rediscover what it is that our assets are, our local capacities, what we've got to build on. And it's rediscovered the sort of basic truth that every community is built on the gifts of individuals, on their mobilization by citizens' associations, including churches, and by somehow recapturing for community building the focus of local institutions. And so most of what our stories in our book is about is how people have begun to reconstruct a map that looks like this and then work with it. And therefore, what we begin to be describing is a process that has three characteristics to it. If somebody said, what does community building in cities look like these days? I would say, number one, it's asset-based, not needs-based. You don't start by counting up your needs. You start by counting up what you got. The individuals, the associations, the institutions, the income, the talent that's there. Not by counting up your needs. I sit on a couple foundation boards in Chicago, and we get needs surveys all the time across our desk. I haven't learned anything from a needs survey in 15 years. You tell me the neighborhood, I can fill it in myself. I know what the needs are, and so does everybody else. But the minute you start looking at assets in the neighborhood, everything changes. It's always different from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood. Reading is not the same as any neighborhood in Philadelphia. So community building is asset-based. And secondly, if it's asset-based, it is necessarily, first of all, internally focused. That is, you don't look outside for your help first. You don't apply to the United Way. You don't apply to the ELCA. You don't apply to Washington, D.C. You figure out how it is that local people, their associations and institutions can solve problems first. So it's asset-based, it's internally focused, and the third thing is, this we've sort of relearned, and this is all simple stuff and ancient, is that it's about relationship building. Because this other map is a relationship-busting map. If I'm a welfare recipient, or if I'm a community leader in a low-income community in a city, a welfare recipient, my welfare depends on my relationship to my welfare worker. If I'm a community leader, I get designated that way by tracking money, you see? So my relationship that's important is to my funder. This map doesn't make me look to my family, to my extended family, to my neighbors, to my block, to my community to solve problems. This map makes me look outside. So what we have here is an invitation to look inside to each other to build relationships. Let me just leave you a few minutes for discussion here, but let me just leave you with an image about that. What we're seeing over and over and over again, Ben, the right things here, are processes where every sector of the community begins to think about itself as at the center of a whole set of relationships. Here's a church that has two-way relationships with everything else in the community. And the two-way relationships are about local problem solving, Chris, right? They're about how do you figure out how your church relates to the local school, the local business association, local tenants association, police, daycare centers, community development corporations, the local community colleges, homeless. How are concrete, programmatic, problem-solving relationships put together around the church that make a difference? Lots to be said about that. But then the parks leaders do the same thing, and the schools leaders, and the library leaders. And what you get here then, let me make this really messy because it's democracy. Mm-hmm. Layer. This is the messy image of community problem solving, where everything in the community is connected with everything else first, where people can then look around and say, we may not have everything we need here in the South Bronx or on the west side of Chicago or in South Central Los Angeles, but everything we've got, we've discovered, and we've related it all to everything else. Now, what we've also done is to convene everybody around a vision and a vision-forming process and a plan. And we will never again go to the ELCA with our hands up, or to Washington, D.C., or to the United Way with our hands out. From here on in, this community goes to the outside with a hand extended this way and says, the relationship we're interested in is partnership and investment, not charity. We're no longer charity case. We're partner at this point. And you can see what we have invested here ourselves first. Then you know that you've got a real community building process going. And I think what we found in hundreds of communities across the United States is this beginning to happen. And once this begins to happen, then that's a huge challenge for institutions like the ELCA, or local, state, or federal government, or philanthropy to catch up, to run and catch up, and to try to figure out how not to step on this process, how to help it. So a whole other discussion would focus on the question that would face those of us who have our feet in institutions that could help this process and say, how would you reimagine a government that didn't dictate, or a church that didn't dictate, but that in fact responded creatively to local initiatives and to local planning of a congregation like you've been involved in, Chris? That's what community building is about. I think there's a lot of possibilities there. I think a lot of this is happening. I think institutions, the last thing I want to say, we may be at a time at the end of the 20th century, which is globally earth-shaking in the way we live together. Business worldwide and government worldwide are all thinking about new ways to operate. They're all like this, they're old style hierarchies with somebody at the top shoving orders down. And they're all thinking about ways to flatten themselves, whether it's Deming in the business world or reinventing government in the public sector. It's about flattening decision making. It's about pushing decision making down to people who are actually doing the work. It's about customer driven, right? That's a big word now in lots of these institutional reform. This is about the question, what can you think about in terms of communities under these institutions? How do you think about communities? In cities, and I think now in smaller communities as well, where people can retake the power to shape community life and not depend on institutions, which were, I think, maybe a quirky invention of the industrial age, and maybe have outlived, at least in their hierarchical and huge manifestation, may have outlived their usefulness. So it could be we're at a basic sea change here. We're at a basic place where the entire social order gets reinvented, and where this piece of it is about how in the world do people called citizens, at least in democracy, retake community space as problem-solving space. That's happening in cities all over. And for me, it's an incredible sign of hope. Yeah. Reactions. Does any of this make any sense at all?
To me, the real crux of the problem, I love all that you had to say. It's absolutely. My experience with institutions is they are of all kinds. Is that they're going to be a real problem because they aren't going to give up their power easily, and they have become really so entrenched. A lot of people make their living through those institutions.
Well, that's right.
And their power is really insidious because they don't really care about any of this. They don't care about these people that are suffering. They don't care about any of these problems. They simply wish to perpetuate themselves. And so, are you really optimistic about it? That in institutions, as I know them, that you know them, yeah, really can change and can.
I have to say, actually, that I'm more optimistic than I was 2 or 3 years ago, because the sea change, I think, is deeper than I had recognized. For instance, and partly it is because people have all over, at least in the industrialized world, recognized the limitations of this. This has limits. This is an endless resource gobbler. If you're worried about budget, this is where resources go in ever, ever growing amounts. And even the European states, who have lots of good things to report about their welfare economies, are finding that the one thing they can't report is that they can sustain them economically, right? So the question is, what's the option to this? Whether this needs to be replaced because it's dysfunctional as a kind of tool of oppression, which I think is the way it functions in the United States in lots of ways, or it's dysfunctional because we simply can't afford it. which is the way it's closer to the way it is in Sweden, I think. I think more and more, 2 years ago, I would not have said, for example, that this kind of an approach would have any future in the United Way. The United Way, those of you who are aware, you remember the United Way's ads, right? They're all about huge, hulking, healthy football players who are helping out really clearly decrepit little kids, right? I mean, you couldn't have a more sort of charity-oriented, strong and weak, empty, deficient, full, right? I mean, it is not a democratic image at all. It's charity to the nth degree. But even the United Way has begun to see the limits of that and have therefore begun to put some resources even in some places into an idea that what they ought to be doing in some places is to support communities' capacities to care for themselves and for each other. And that's a radical shift. I mean, the United Way to me would be one of the last. The other, you know, there are other examples around the empowerment zone stuff. You know, I don't know if those of you who have been close to the empowerment zone legislation, this is the federal legislation from the Clinton administration that's about rebuilding communities and cities that Reading has some interest in, clearly. This is a multi-billion dollar program, and its application is 8 pages. Anybody who's had anything to do with the federal government will see that and just go, good grief, what happened? I mean, a multi-billion dollar application you could expect from the federal government to be this thick with just endless forms to fill out. This is 8 pages. And what they ask for in those 8 pages is basic information, and then send us, they say, a wide and deep community plan that tells us about how much of the citizenry of your community has been involved in formulating a vision and a strategy about where your community is going. That's different. That wouldn't have happened. That's not what Model Cities was. It's not what anything in the Reagan administration or Bush administration was about. It's a very different conception of what a central kind of outfit could be like. I don't know if ELCA doesn't do anything like that. Sort of say, we've got some resources here. Give us a rational plan for how to use them and convince us that you could use them better than anybody else. Right? Which is what your congregation is, not Chris. If you had that at your synod office, you probably would qualify and get some money. But we haven't quite learned that yet. But the federal government is trying to do that. It is, though, you're right. You know, we've worked a lot with HUD and the Clinton administration on this stuff, and it's a little bit like, did you go to the circus when you were a kid? It is like watching an elf and learn to dance.
Well, we began this discussion.
It's really painful. You know the elephant was not made to dance. And it's clear when it starts trying to dance that it wasn't ever made to dance. But it does try, you know. And once it does, there's a sort of awkward grace to it. So who knows? Sven?
Why the shift? Did representatives from areas that have successful programs see it and want to change, or did the administration find out about it?
No, this is all bottom-up. It's clear to me. This is a reaction of creative and energetic local people in low-income neighborhoods across the United States to severely constrained conditions where resources were drying up and they had no place to turn but to each other.
So I meant the federal program and the aid, that's just 8 pages.
Oh, the empowerment zone?
Yeah.
Well, it's also a reaction. Henry Cisneros, who was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, was the mayor of San Antonio. And Cisneros is somebody who got put in office by the communities of San Antonio, which were organized. He didn't get put into office because he worked the party politics. He got put into office because the Industrial Areas Foundation, which is a national network of community organizations, was strong in San Antonio, particularly in the Spanish-speaking communities in San Antonio. And they organized for years and years and years around a variety of issues. They didn't even have water in some of those neighborhoods in San Antonio, right? And Cisneros was part of that. part of that whole movement of community stuff in San Antonio, and they finally elected him mayor. So that the neighborhoods of San Antonio, particularly the Mexican neighborhoods of San Antonio, had somebody in Cisneros whom they could hold accountable. So Cisneros comes to HUD, then, in Washington, D.C., with an experience that's very different from most mayors and from most political leaders. He comes with an idea that people in low-income communities can be capable and smart, and that, in fact, there's a lot of capacity to do things there that never gets tapped. So I think partly the empowerment zone legislation, and he's got a whole set of things that he's doing that he calls reinventing HUD, Housing and Urban Development, which are terrifically interesting, and they have to do with the experience that he brought there, but it also has to do with Clinton's appreciation for that experience. I mean, he didn't just get there on his own. I don't agree with everything that's going on in the Clinton administration, but I do think there's some bright spots and some interesting things going on. Yeah.
Is Habitat for Humanity kind of an organization that may take into consideration not the neighborhood needs map more than the others? I mean, it seems to me that they really try to empower the neighborhood rather than just look at the needs.
There are, in my own mind, Carol, to shorthand it, I've had two kinds of Habitat experiences. One is the experience where Jimmy and Rosalind Carter come into a community and they're, you know, whoever their surrogates are, and they're sort of angels from the outside,
yeah,
and they're do-gooders from the outside, and they sweep in and they do a house in a week or two or
30
you know,
houses in
or
five
30,
days.
Exactly, 30 houses in 5 days, and they leave.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I'm glad the houses are there. I'm glad people are finding something useful to do with their time, but I'm not that interested in it. I do think there's a second kind of Habitat project that's going on now that seems to be a second generation Habitat project where they learn something, where people come in from the outside still, but one of the clear, it's as important to the project that relationships across barriers get built, which sustain themselves beyond the housing project, and that those relationships are as much at the heart of what the project is about as creating the housing is. I'm much more interested in that because I think there are incredible possibilities when people in suburbs and people with resources begin to know folks in inner city neighborhoods. I mean, this needs map makes no sense the minute you start meeting with mothers who've taken over their public housing. And they are incredible people. They're just, you know, constantly surprising in what it is they can. And so those relationships are awfully important. Rick?
I keep thinking about the kind of the people on the giving end, like the Habitat thing. And perhaps a misguided picture of their fullness. And perhaps not enough attention to their own emptiness. And particularly if we think about suburban areas, the high growth areas, there are big concentrations of people in those areas and a need for community.
Yeah.
And a need for a sense of community and not recognizing in their situation, you know, a sense that both within themselves and a perception of others outside that they're full, they don't need anything, but in fact they do have needs, and if there's any future life in those areas, there has to be some development of sense.
Just a quick response. We're not convinced that although this work has been focused on and continues to be focused for us on low-income communities and cities, that the lessons it's taught us about community building have a much broader kind of relevancy. And that, in fact, what's happening, I think, now, maybe oversimplify here, but we all, many of us in this room, grew up in neighborhoods or in communities, some church-centered, which were still powerfully inherited communities, where we came into a community and all of our relationships, to some degree or another, we could assume we were fish in water. We knew where we were. We knew who we were in community. That's what ethnicity was about in the United States. And it's true, I think, now in all kinds of communities, and not just in inner city communities, but in suburbs and all over the place, that you can't assume that anymore. that communities are much more, geographic communities are much more heterogeneous and more mobile. And that we've got now a set of challenges that we haven't ever had before, which is to say that we are all faced with the challenge of, as at Holden, being very self-conscious about recreating.